استشهاد فلسطينيين في خان يونس
لتربح سيارة دودج تشارجر 2000.
New media outlets in the Arab world could transform the political and cultural landscape of the entire region.
There's about 250 or so satellite stations now. They keep expanding literally every week.
Will this rapidly expanding Arab media spectrum lead to greater understanding and political freedom, or fuel tension, fear, and hatred?
I think there is a great need to get American viewpoints out there to a Middle Eastern audience.
I think the American policy is explained very well to the Arabs by Arab television stations in Arabic.
I'm David Brancaccio. Join me this hour for 24/7, The Rise and Influence of Arab Media, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio.
The militants are aided as well by elements of the Arab news media that incite hatred.
More after this. I'm David Brancaccio, and this is 24/7, The Rise and Influence of Arab Media, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio.
نطلب مبلغا كبيرا مقابله لنستطيع السفر الى الخارج.
The information revolution that swept the Western world over the last two decades is now transforming the Arab world. New radio stations, websites, text messaging, and much more are breaking down cultural barriers and challenging the hardened old order. But none of these innovations is having more of an impact than hundreds of Arabic language satellite television stations. They come directly into homes, and even the most repressive governments in the region find them almost impossible to block. And because they're easily available at low or sometimes no cost to the viewer, rich and poor alike now have a dizzying array of TV choices.
This is the ArabSat. And then we have Qatar Television, and then other channels. KTV is Kuwait Television for children. JSC means Al Jazeera.
The living room in the home of Najwa Karadzha in Jordan illustrates the scale of this brave new world. No fewer than 5 remotes are laid out on a table to control 8 separate satellite dishes, bringing more than 500 channels to her home. The Karadzha family can see HBO and CNN, as well as Nile TV from Egypt, Future TV of Lebanon, and even Hamas TV, a station run by the radical Palestinian group with a long history of terrorism. Satellite distribution has given even the tiniest network regional reach and brought Arabic language news, talk shows, and no-holds-barred political debates that were unthinkable 10 years ago. The Karadzha family no doubt recognizes this music, even if you listening right now don't. It is the Al Jazeera news theme. Of course, you've heard of Al Jazeera, yet most of us know very little about it or the station's many news competitors in the Arab world. Al Jazeera is headquartered in Doha, Qatar, a tiny country on the shores of the strategically vital Persian Gulf. The Gulf is also home to Al Jazeera's main competition, Al Arabiya, a 24-hour news channel broadcasting from the city of Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Kristen McHugh takes us behind the scenes of these controversial Arabic news broadcasters.
Sometimes I work in the morning, early morning, like 6 o'clock, I finish 2 o'clock.
Mai Sharbini is an anchor with Dubai-based Al Arabiya News. Al Arabiya, financed by a wealthy Saudi businessman, is the second most watched satellite news channel in the region. Wearing khaki pants, a pink Oxford, and a fashionable brown blazer as she drives to the studio, Mai represents the modern face of Arab media.
Until 1991, all the broadcast media in the Arab world used to be government-controlled and government-owned, and none of the programs used to be live.
Nabil Khatib, Mai's boss, is the executive editor of Al Arabiya News.
All this media used to be away from the professional standards.
Khatib is referring to so-called state-run radio and television news channels. Many still exist, but they are no longer the first and only option. Today, viewers across the region have their choice of hundreds of satellite television news, entertainment, and sports networks.
أول طرد في لقاء اليوم.
When 2020 returns.
The roots of the rapidly expanding media landscape in the Arab world can be traced to the end of the Cold War and the start of the first U.S. Gulf War.
Let's describe to our viewers what we're seeing. The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated.
For the first time, new consumer satellite technology beamed CNN's live coverage of events in Kuwait and Iraq to the Arab region unfiltered. This radical departure gave the Arab region an entirely new perspective. Again, Nabil Hatib.
Lots of Arabs realized that all the information they were getting from Arab sources, whether governmental or from Iraqis or from Kuwaitis or from their own media about the war, it was fake. I mean, most of the information was not true.
Winding her way through Dubai's seemingly endless road construction, Mai Sharbini recalls her reaction when she discovered CNN.
I remember when I was studying, when CNN was aired to the Middle East. You know, it was very, very new, and you would never think watching news 24 hours.
CNN's approach to news, and that of other Western outlets such as BBC, not only influenced Mai Sharbini's career path, they also shaped the look, sound, and image of today's Arab satellite news channels.
Now, Arab TV stations and even newspapers, radio stations, they realize that if they are to survive or to retain some of their audience, they will have to become more objective.
Ahmed Sheikh is editor-in-chief of Al Jazeera News.
Now they realize that the audience is not really stupid. They understand there is another example in front of the audience. So I think before Al Jazeera, you had a very sort of stagnant Arabic-speaking media in the Arab world.
Ahmed Sheikh's office overlooks the newsroom of Al Jazeera's recently expanded headquarters in Doha, Qatar. This sleek, colorful, and high-tech newsroom is a direct reflection of the network's success. Al Jazeera, which is financed by the royal family of Qatar, is the most watched and best known pan-Arab satellite news channel. It is so successful that in 2004, advertising executives ranked the network the fifth most powerful brand in the world. But Al Jazeera is also highly controversial in both the United States and Middle East.
Initially, actually, a lot of governments in the Arab world did feel very skeptical about Al Jazeera.
Wada Khanfar is Al Jazeera's managing director.
And then they started criticizing Al Jazeera. When we started, we were accused initially as a Mossad Israeli conspiracy or a CIA American tool. Many bureaus of Al Jazeera were closed down and a lot of correspondents were arrested. And on many occasions, we were dealt with in a very bad way.
Al Jazeera, whose motto is the opinion and the other opinion, began broadcasting in 1996. In a few short years, the network expanded its daily news programming from 6 hours to around-the-clock coverage. Today, Al Jazeera boasts tens of millions of daily viewers and more than 25 news bureaus around the world. The network also operates a number of separate channels. These include Al Jazeera Sports and Al Jazeera Live, similar to American C-SPAN. There's also the Al Jazeera Children's Network. And Al Jazeera International, the network's first English-language news channel, will be broadcasting live daily from Kuala Lumpur, Doha, London, and Washington, D.C. before the end of 2006.
Al Jazeera, Al
Jazeera, Washington.
But as Al Jazeera continues to expand, the network faces sharp criticism, especially in the United States, that it broadcasts dangerously inflammatory views.
Well, there's no question that we track Al Jazeera coverage. We do editorial content analysis of Al Jazeera on a daily basis, not only what's being broadcast from their television networks, but also their internet sites.
Army Captain Eric Clark works for the U.S. Central Command's media engagement team in Dubai. He is responsible for presenting the American point of view to the Arab media.
We use that to counter their lies and propaganda or simple misreports, so we use that as a tool to engage them.
Al Jazeera's critics argue the network is simply anti-American. Others argue the station is pro-Al-Qaeda, or at a minimum, being used by Al-Qaeda and other extremist organizations, since the network frequently receives and broadcasts taped messages from Osama bin Laden and other Al-Qaeda leaders.
Al Jazeera is the poster child for a form of radical political media that's emerging in the Arab world.
Elin Berman is vice president for policy at the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington.
Al Jazeera is a propaganda outlet as well as a news agency, and it's one that promotes ideas that are very inimical to American interests. There are many outlets that operate as honest brokers for the news that's out there. Al Jazeera, in many cases, is not one of them. And it's not one of them because it's inherently more ideologically proximate to Al-Qaeda and to other regional radicals.
Al Jazeera is not anti-American.
Again, Al Jazeera Managing Director Wada Khanfar.
From our point of view as journalists, Osama bin Laden tape does carry news and is newsworthy. And I think for any professional journalist, a tape for Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda leaders is important news.
Back in the newsroom, editor Ahmad Sheikh says Al Jazeera handles any and all tapes received from Al-Qaeda or others in the same manner it treats all news, the network's 10-point code of ethics.
When we receive a tape by bin Laden, we choose certain quotes that we believe are newsworthy, and we put it in there, and we drop out all the other things that we believe are just propaganda. So we are not a mouthpiece to Osama bin Laden. And for God's sake, we did not divide the world into two camps. And it is not Al Jazeera who installed Osama bin Laden as the head of the camp of evil.
Al Jazeera is paying a high price for its high profile. The network isn't allowed to officially operate in some Arab countries. Several reporters and cameramen have been killed, detained, or jailed. U.S. missiles destroyed Al Jazeera's Kabul, Afghanistan bureau in 2001 and the network's Baghdad operation in 2003. And in late 2005, allegations surfaced in the British press that President Bush discussed bombing Al Jazeera's headquarters, allegations the White House vigorously denies. In fact, the U.S. government strongly denies Al Jazeera is or has been specifically targeted.
There are a number of things that Al Jazeera is learning as they're maturing.
Even America's point man for Arab media in Dubai, military spokesman Captain Eric Clark, acknowledges Al Jazeera's news is changing.
They've instilled this code of ethics. They have a new way of approaching Al-Qaeda video. They no longer show beheadings and things that would turn the stomachs of a normal person on the street of the pan-Arab community or America or Europe. So there are a number of things that we're seeing in terms of Al Jazeera reacting to the marketplace and reacting to their viewership.
Here we are. But we're early enough to get a parking place.
Back in Dubai, Al Arabiya anchor Mai Sharbini arrives at her network's cutting-edge studio located in Dubai Media City for her midday shift. The rapid rise of Arab media is front and center here in Dubai's Media City. 5 years ago, there were only three buildings in this industrial complex built to attract media companies. Today, this government-sponsored censor-free zone houses bureaus for Reuters, CNN, CNBC, and other news operations from around the world. Media City's former desert landscape is now populated with scores of buildings, even skyscrapers, as far as the eye can see. And demand has outpaced supply. Workers can't construct buildings fast enough, but companies hoping to rent space here will have to join a waiting list. All current and future planned space in Dubai Media City is already under contract.
What's amazing just to watch the media growth. The number of media outlets has grown exponentially.
Again, Army Captain Eric Clark.
I think one of the interesting things to see is that if you take a look at the demographic breakdown of pan-Arab press, they do have a Western influence. They've worked for CNN or BBC. They've worked for print outlets.
Oops.
My Sharbini's first stop of the day is Al Arabiya's makeup studio. Here, stylists work around the clock applying makeup and setting hair for the network's on-camera personalities. Mai then turns her attention to the newsroom.
The first thing to open is that the running order of the bulletin that I read.
I think newsrooms have become universal throughout the Arab world, and it's very similar with what's been happening in the West.
Jihad Balut is Al Arabiya's director of corporate communications.
I think the difference lies in the audience preferences. I don't think CNN shies away from the fact that it's culturally American and it targets American audiences, although it's called international. Our organization is called Al Arabiya, which means the Arabic one, so you can't get more clear than that.
3, 2, 1. Role. Honor.
For 24/7, I'm Kristen McHugh, Dubai Media City.
And cue.
The reality is that there's about 250 or so satellite stations now. They keep expanding literally every week.
Rami Khoury is editor-at-large for the Daily Star of Beirut, one of the largest newspapers in the Middle East. He closely tracks pan-Arab satellite television channels.
A lot of them are very, very narrowly focused. The ones that deal in general public affairs and news, political issues, there's probably about a dozen sort of serious ones, but really you're only talking about 4 or 5 that have major regional and international impact. And I would argue that they're actually doing very high quality journalism. They're very, very professional in their motivation, and I think increasingly professional in their conduct.
Khoury says this change in professionalism has been on display during the Iraq War. In fact, he argues channels like Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera are providing the best war coverage anywhere.
There's absolutely no doubt in my mind. It's the only place where you could hear an official American speech by Rumsfeld or Bush or somebody, and then you would hear the Arab reaction. You really saw both sides of the picture live, simultaneous, in color, and in Arabic.
Rising professionalism or not, critics of Al Jazeera and its competitors have a serious list of complaints about the channels. Near the top of the list is a sense that specific outlets or individual political programs fuel anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli hatred in the region. Ariel Cohen is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C.
The norms and standards of responsible journalism, for example, call to have both sides of the story presented. But I went over transcripts of Al Jazeera coverage, which gave currency to lies and myths, and only the Palestinian sources were quoted. No Israelis were interviewed for those stories whatsoever, and it has been done repeatedly. And I think anyone who cares about coexistence between Christians, Muslims, and Jews should denounce Al Jazeera for consistently giving the voice to the most radical, most hateful representatives of jihadi Islam.
But regional observers of Al Jazeera argue that the network's editorial tone reflects perceptions that are widely shared in the Middle East. Again, Rami Khoury.
There are some shows, some sort of drama series, that certainly can be criticized at some levels for being critical of Israel, of Zionism as such. But I don't think that there is a systematic anti-Semitic streak. Absolutely not. I think there are some people, of course, in the Arab world who do make anti-Semitic statements, as there are in the United States and in Europe. This is a fact of life, and unfortunately we have to fight against it, but it is certainly not systematic.
Another major critique of these Arabic news channels is that they misrepresent U.S. policies and American intentions in the Middle East. But Khoury says the problem may be the message, not the messenger.
There's a huge wrong analysis in the U.S. government with the idea that, well, the Arabs don't really understand our values, they don't understand our policies, they don't understand what we're trying to do, and that's why they criticize us. Well, that's nonsense. I think the American policy is explained very well to the Arabs by Arab television stations in Arabic. So it's not a question of misunderstanding the Americans, it's a question of disagreeing with American policy. And this is not just the Arabs who disagree, it's almost the whole world.
You're listening to 24/7, The Rise and Influence of Arab Media, from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio, on the web at stanleyfoundation.org and kqed.org. Coming up, how is the new Arab media changing the region? And what is any of this to us living in America? I'm David Brancaccio. More after this. Thank you.
Dimki, Targan.
These are the world's hotspots. Thursdays and Fridays at 10 p.m. Riyadh time on the History Channel.
India's most trusted airline embarks on a new journey.
I'm David Brancaccio, and this is 24/7, the rise and influence of Arab media from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio. In the center of the Jordanian capital, Amman, construction crews have been hard at work putting the finishing touches on one of the region's newest broadcast facilities. You might think that with more than 250 satellite stations already on the air in the Arab world, there isn't much room for anything new on the dial. But the backers of Jordan's Al Rad newspaper disagree, and they're preparing to launch the country's first privately owned television station later this year. As correspondent Simon Marks found out on a visit to Jordan and neighboring Syria, the battle for the dominance of the Arab media landscape is by no means settled.
A few seconds before 8 o'clock on a weekday evening, and Dana Jordan is getting ready to go on the air. In her mid-20s, she's Western-educated, charismatic, and lively. And hers is the new primetime face of Jordanian television news.
Well, actually, the 8 o'clock news bulletin is the main news bulletin at Jordan Television. It concentrates on the local news more than the international news. Anything related to the king, prime minister, or any ministers, any events happening in Jordan, whether they're economic or sports or political events as well, you can find that they're concentrated in this news bulletin.
What happens in Studio One of the government-run Jordan Television every night used to be the envy of the Arab world. Back in 1968, JTV was one of the first television networks established in the Middle East. It went on to become one of the first broadcasters to offer viewers two channels of programming, and one of the first to shift from black and white to color. But today, JTV is under pressure, losing audience members and experienced employees to the pan-Arab satellite channels that have come to dwarf it.
The estimation is about 55-60% of Jordanian households do own satellite dishes with access to over 400 stations. Now that is competition.
Facing that competition, JTV is not throwing in the towel. On the day we visited, Chief Executive Mustafa Hamana insisted by retooling the network, he was positioning it for a comeback.
As we improve the 8 o'clock news, eventually you will have almost the entire elite locked up at that 8 o'clock news, no matter what Al Jazeera, Al Arabi, and others have on their screen.
And so Jordan Television's reporters now relentlessly focus on the local beat. Heading off from JTV's newsroom, a reporter briefs his cameraman about their story for the day, the drought, and when the local weather bureau expects it to rain. JTV is still wholly owned by the government here, and the weather story, like many others on the 8 o'clock news, will include an interview with a government minister. And George Hawatma, former editor of the government-run Jordan Times newspaper, says that illustrates the dilemma in which JTV finds itself.
It's a new world for the media. I'm not sure it has fundamentally changed, though. The government might well feel that television station is its television station, that there is still a vertical relationship with the people who operate it.
To understand what JTV is up against, you only have to visit the Wehdat refugee camp on the outskirts of Amman. It's not a refugee camp in the classic sense of the phrase. It's been here since 1955 and looks increasingly like a permanent settlement for more than 45,000 Palestinians whose families sought refuge in Jordan during and after the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. In the living room of their spartanly decorated home, three generations of the Al-Akras family gather round the television. Khalid Al-Akras and his wife Lika moved here in 1967 when they fled Jericho.
I trust the channel which is fastest, Al Jazeera, because it has many correspondents and it conveys accurate news faster than the other channels. It has more correspondents than the others, so it transmits the news faster.
Also popular in this overwhelmingly poor neck of the Jordanian woods are the channels that transmit readings from the Quran 24 hours a day. There are several of them available from various satellite distributors, and like Christian television and radio in the U.S. Bible Belt, you can hear them echoing through the neighborhoods.
In my old days, before TV, it was BBC.
Wael Karadzha lives at the other end of the economic and social spectrum. A retired Jordanian diplomat, he's a prominent figure on the political circuit in Amman. And like many Jordanian intellectuals, he won't watch Al Jazeera, accusing the network of pandering to the radical political sensibilities of its mass audience.
And they have certain programs that are very obnoxious, unfortunately. And they disappointed us. And few times I really get upset and say, my God. Why attack Jordan? Why say this and that? I change sometimes to Al Arabiya, which is coming new. And I find more moderation and more realism and factual and not prejudiced or attacking.
It is that sense of viewer dissatisfaction that Jordanian television and its new private competitor hope to capitalize upon. Al Rad is already Jordan's most successful privately owned newspaper. Now it's getting into the broadcasting business, building 2 6-camera studios with picture windows overlooking downtown Amman.
There's no more loyalty to stations. It's only loyalty to content and to specific programs.
Mohammed Al-Ayan owns Al Rad and believes he can make money by running a commercial, locally focused television station in Jordan. He argues the government-run JTV has done well wooing viewers back from the satellite stations. And he says Al Jazeera in particular is vulnerable to allegations of bias.
If you are subsidized, if you keep losing money, $50, $60 million every year, and somebody is subsidizing, basically, you are obliged to follow the agenda of the person who's subsidized, whoever that person is. So therefore, you cannot really say that it is independent.
That there is even a discussion about the independence of media in Jordan is testament in part to the influence of the pan-Arab satellite channels. Had they not come along, Mohammed Al-Ayan acknowledges it might still not be possible for a private businessman to own newspapers and television stations in a part of the world where the media has traditionally been under state control. And that is certainly true in neighboring Syria, which only now is beginning to experiment with a loosening of the government reins. As we wandered through the 12th century Souk al-Hamadiyya, the market in the center of the Syrian capital, where you can buy everything from strong Arabic coffee and spices to the latest fashions imported from Paris, we stumbled across a decidedly old-style scene being filmed by government-run Syrian television. A patriotic song rang out from loudspeakers as a Syrian cameraman was gingerly hoisted above a crowd whose members were all waving the country's flag. To the evident frustration of the Syrian television director sent to acquire enough footage to create a music video, the crowd had not learnt the words, and several takes were ordered before they got them right. The director, Mohammed Skia, insisted that we were witnessing a spontaneous outpouring of national pride in the country's achievements.
We are directing a message to all the people of the world that Syria is a country of proud and courageous people. It's more than a song, it's a presentation for the whole world to see that we have millions of people, from 2-year-old kids to 70-year-old men, so that we can show the world Syria is not what they think it is. Syria is a peaceful country.
But Syria has been in a defensive mood after the United Nations accused it of involvement in the assassination of several prominent figures in neighboring Lebanon. Syrian television dutifully broadcasts the music videos and other government-inspired programming, not just inside Syria, but on a satellite channel that is seen across the Middle East. Despite that seemingly heavy-handed control of the media and the message, there is liberalization underway in Damascus that in its own way is transforming society even here.
And now we're writing a lot of sensitive issues, and sometimes we're really surprised that we passed the censorship.
27-year-old Kinda Kanbar is the managing editor of Syria Today, a glossy English-language magazine produced from a newsroom in the so-called Free Zone in downtown Damascus. The Free Zone was established by President Bashar al-Assad to encourage foreign investors to build manufacturing plants on territory that is officially free from Syrian government taxation and control. After the magazine is printed, she must submit it for government censorship. But to her amazement, she says not a single article has ever been changed.
150 words. We do not know exactly what is our red lines. Meaning by that, there is no guidelines or a law to tell you do not talk about this issue or not. It's a gray area. And sometimes you draw your red lines. And if you're really pushy and you're really brave enough and taking responsibility in a professional way, you can push it.
And there is some pushing of those red lines underway at Syrian television as well. The nightly news, broadcast from an imposing building in the heart of Damascus, now carries live coverage of events that in the past would have been considered too hot to handle. When the United Nations discussed allegations that the Syrian government was behind the string of assassinations in Lebanon, it did so live on Syrian television. The network is now overseen by Diana Jabour, Syrian TV's chief executive. She is not a member of the ruling Ba'ath Party, and she was appointed after writing a newspaper article critical of the Syrian regime. Asked about how much freedom her reporters now have, and she laughs.
The difference is that they have more freedom than they're taking advantage of. The funny thing about this situation is that we are given more freedom now, but as editors and individuals, we still don't have the courage to push things to the limit.
Diana Jabour says the journalists working in her newsroom would never have won the relative freedoms they now enjoy had it not been for the legalization of satellite dish ownership in Syria. Everywhere you go in Damascus, there are dishes crowding the rooftops. And the presentation of news on the pan-Arab satellite stations has, she says, changed everything here.
I cannot market an image of Syria that does not exist. That would be stupid. It would be stupid for me to think that my viewers are stupid because they know the truth. They know the reality, and they will not watch my channel. They'll switch off.
The Syrian government also points to satellite ownership as being a key factor in its decision to liberalize local media laws and make Syrian journalists more competitive. Until recently, Mehdi Dakhlala was Syria's Minister of Information. The former editor of the ruling party's hardline newspaper Al-Ba'ath, even he has bowed to the inevitable.
Any Syrian today can watch over 300 Arab satellite channels, and they have a variety of sources for information. This makes directed media impossible, 100% impossible, and public opinion is pressuring the government for more liberalization of media.
You're going to be Syria's last Minister of Information?
Inshallah.
Inshallah, with God's help, he says, though he did not get his wish. A few weeks after our interview, he was replaced in a cabinet reshuffle. But Syrian journalists like Kinda Kanbar say the changes already instituted are unlikely to be reversed.
Well, actually, what the government can do, you're going to keep this country shut? They can't do anything. Life is changing.
For 24/7, I'm Simon Marks, Damascus, Syria.
Al Jazeera is in Doha, Qatar. Al Arabiya is in Dubai, the UAE. And you've never seen them covering stories from the Gulf.
Khala Matar is the deputy editor-in-chief of Al Wakdan, a daily newspaper in Bahrain. She believes that Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya honor red lines of their own when it comes to avoiding coverage of controversial issues in their respective backyards.
You never see them raising issues of concern to Gulf citizens. If you close your eyes and just listen to Al Jazeera many times, you wouldn't think that Al Jazeera is in Qatar. I'm not revealing anything. Everybody who watches Al Jazeera can feel that Al Jazeera has a position towards the American foreign policy.
Matar argues that it all boils down to a question of who owns the two largest pan-Arab networks and therefore subsidizes what are enormous financial losses. There are no reliable audience ratings covering the entire Arab world, but public opinion polls clearly and consistently show Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya as the most watched news channels in the region. Al Jazeera is financed by the royal family of Qatar. Al Arabiya gets a lot of its money from a Saudi businessman linked to the Saudi royal family. Matar says there is a reluctance on both channels to bite the hand with the cash.
I think that this pan-Arab media is highly modern. I mean, they use all the fancy equipment, but it's still very conservative when it comes to social issues. And that's why they shy away from these issues, because the ownership is very conservative. The package is very modern, but the content is still very traditional.
To support her argument, Hala Matar singles out the coverage of women's issues on both networks. The Saudi-backed Al Arabiya, she says, never discusses the repression of women's rights in the kingdom. And she says Al Jazeera fences in the debate over the role of women by consigning it to a special weekly program.
Al Jazeera is so much open for political discussion. And when it comes to women's issues, they just packaged it in that program and they called it Only for Women. And it's really produced by a very conservative wife of a clergyman, woman, who gets all the conservative views about how women should wear the veil, and if they don't wear the veil, they go to hell, and things like this. And I'm not against the veil, but I'm just trying to say that there are other views in this region that are not heard.
Good morning again. I'm Diane Sawyer.
And of course, the Green Bay Packers finally...
The future belongs to inventive thinking.
إنكم تعرفون هؤلاء الشبان أليس كذلك؟ حسناً لقد حان الوقت للانتقال لأن الجو ذاهب إلى لوس أنجلوس.
Flipping through the hundreds of television channels available across the Middle East, it becomes apparent that local residents see a heavy dose of American programming. But this by no means has bridged all of the cultural gaps between Arabs and the West. The explosion of media choices in the region is being watched with fascination, marvel, and dread by the foreign policy community in Washington, D.C. Soon after Al Jazeera began showing up on television sets throughout the Arab world, American officials praised its potential for spreading democracy and free expression across the region. They set out on what amounted to a charm offensive, appearing frequently on it and other Arab media outlets, adding the U.S. perspective to the mix of coverage. Then came 9/11.
Both trade towers, where thousands of people work, on this day, Tuesday, have now been attacked and destroyed, with thousands of people either in them or in the immediate area adjacent to them. There is simply no way to accurately describe the emotion this evokes in people all over the world.
The U.S.-led invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq followed. Arab media outlets covered both conflicts, often in ways President Bush and indeed many other Americans found troubling. Sometimes there were images of dead American soldiers or hostages being beheaded. Sometimes there was material from Osama bin Laden and other enemies of the United States. The U.S. charm offensive turned into a war of words.
The militants are aided as well by elements of the Arab news media that incite hatred and anti-Semitism, that feed conspiracy theories, and speak of a so-called American war on Islam.
Can American security interests in the Middle East be reconciled with something as unruly as the new pan-Arab media? Correspondent Sam Litzinger looks for answers in Washington, D.C.
Good evening. President Carter personally appealed to Jordan's King Hussein today to help build real Middle East peace on the framework constructed at Camp David.
For decades, relations between the United States and Arab nations were forged on a diplomatic level, leader to leader, in meetings similar to the historic Camp David peace talks in 1978.
I'm so proud of both of you.
This show of stiff diplomacy, tailor-made for state-run media outlets in the Middle East, lack the people-to-people approach the United States employed during the Cold War with the former Soviet bloc through scientific and cultural exchanges, Radio Free Europe, and VOA, Voice of America, in addition to high-level political summits.
The U.S. for many years thought that the way to deal with the Arab world is to deal with the leaders.
Marina Ottaway, a senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington.
In other words, it never felt that it had to deal with Arab publics, the so-called Arab street, essentially.
So, Your Majesty, thank you for coming. Proud to share the moment with you. Thank you very much for
formal meetings between American and Arab leaders, such as this one between President Bush and Jordan's King Abdullah earlier this year, maintain their high profile, but now they're just one of the many ways the United States reaches out to the Arab world.
Since 9/11, the U.S. has decided that it has to reach out to the population directly, and this is the reason for Radio Sawa, it's the reason for Al-Hurra.
Radio Sawa, headquartered in Washington, D.C., is a 24/7 Arabic language news and entertainment network. Radio Sawa airs an eclectic mix of Western pop and Arabic music. It's one of the efforts the U.S. government is making to try and win over the Arab audience. The other is Al Hurra TV.
On Saturday, February 14th, 2004, a new window opened for Arabic-speaking television viewers all over the Middle East. A window on accurate, objective news reporting. A window on the free marketplace of ideas. A window on a better future. Al Hurra, the free one.
Based in a nondescript industrial park in Springfield, Virginia, Al Hurra beams news, documentaries, and entertainment shows, all in Arabic, to viewers in 22 Middle Eastern countries.
Al Hurra is about you can, not about you can't.
Bert Kleinman is president of the Middle East Broadcasting Networks, the government-funded agency that runs Al Hurra and Radio Sawa.
Our message is one of empowerment, of positivity, of hope for the future, of self-development, of self-actualization, all really core, of, you know, this is what America's about.
But not everyone agrees. The U.S. spends about $90 million annually to keep Al Hurra and Radio Sawa on the air, and the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees all government-owned broadcasting services, is seeking a 13% budget increase next fiscal year.
From almost the moment that Sawa was launched, I heard it being played in Jordanian taxi cabs.
Mark Lynch, political science professor at Williams College, is the author of Voices of the New Arab Public.
I don't think people really paid much attention to the news, and I don't think it had much of an impact at all on political attitudes. But hey, it was nice to be able to get good pop music on the FM band.
I'm not sure that pop music on Radio Sawa is going to influence too many people.
Jim Phillips is a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation in Washington.
It may bring them to the broadcast, but I'm not sure how valuable that would be from the standpoint of U.S. foreign policy.
But Phillips does believe Al Hurra's television programming is meeting certain needs.
I think there is a great need to get American viewpoints and especially U.S. government viewpoints out there to a Middle Eastern audience. Once people see it, they, I think, would grow to trust it because it's not a mouthpiece of the U.S. It provides different views and even some views, many views, critical of the U.S. government.
Proponents of Al Hurra agree, arguing the networks are key to national security and the U.S. war on terrorism. But critics see a problem here, too. They argue Al Hurra parrots the Bush administration's foreign policy line, and consequently, few in the Arab world are paying attention.
Al Hurra is a very unprofessional propaganda machine. This is the great paradox, that while the U.S. is trying to promote an independent press, Al Hurra really does not cut it as an independent TV station.
Again, Marina Ottaway from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I have been interviewed on Al Hurra. I have really debated whether or not I should continue accepting invitations by Al Hurra. And I am saying this very deliberately because they are so unprofessional. They ask leading questions all the time.
Al Hurra executives stand by their objectivity and say they report the news, quote, as it is. So who's watching Al Hurra? Audience surveys can be difficult to conduct in the Middle East, but a University of Maryland Zogby poll done in October 2005 suggests that less than 1% of people in Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Morocco, and the United Arab Emirates watch Al Hurra as their first choice, compared to the 45% who pick Al Jazeera.
For Al Hurra to really establish its credibility with Arab audiences, it would need to cover news and host political opinion, which, if translated and showed to Congress, would immediately get them into a lot of trouble.
Again, Mark Lynch.
Because they're ultimately accountable to Congress, they have to be very careful about the kinds of things that they're going to put on the station, but by doing so, it then undermines its ability to reach out to these Arab audiences.
This raises the question, if Radio Sawa and Al Hurra aren't the answer, how do we engage the Arab public? Mark Lynch argues, don't fight against the Arab media, work with it.
You've got this enormously competitive media market. You've got a politically attuned population who are deeply skeptical of the United States, but who really want to see change in the region. And instead of setting up Al Hurra, Radio Sawa, those sorts of things, and trying to leap over what actually exists, why not take advantage of what's actually there?
Radio Sawa.
Meantime, both Sawa and Al Hurra remain key parts of the U.S. government's Middle East outreach efforts. Al Hurra and Radio Sawa manager Bert Kleinman says the ideas of pluralism and democracy, not related to any particular U.S. administration, have their limitations.
Do we try, or do we just give up and say, people don't like our policies, so let's just shut everything down? I'm too American and too optimistic to just quit and run from the engagement process of trying to engage our audience. And so I can't walk away.
For 24/7, I'm Sam Litzinger, Washington.
If the aim of American television and radio is to change people's opinion of the United States in a big way, I think it can never work.
That is not, as you will notice, the voice of Karen Hughes, the Undersecretary of State responsible for selling U.S. policy to the Arab world. After 6 weeks of trying, the State Department declined our requests for an interview with Hughes, saying it was a scheduling thing. Instead, the voice you just heard is Shibli Telhami, the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. He's researched the impact of satellite television on the Arab world and says if the U.S. wants to influence hearts and minds, it needs a different strategy.
In my own research, I have found no statistically significant relationship between what people watch on television and their attitudes, at least toward the United States, toward core issues. The most important thing we found is exchanges, student exchanges, business exchanges, cultural exchanges. All data show that those people who have interacted with Americans have a significantly better view of the United States than people who didn't, and vice versa.
But Professor Telhami acknowledges not only TV news has changed in the Arab world over the past two decades, major changes have also occurred in the region's entertainment industry, with Arab movie, music, and lifestyle channels all proving popular. Radio and the internet are also ubiquitous. But it is the television industry that he says is poised to climb even greater heights in the years ahead.
When I go to the Middle East now and watch television there or watch it here on satellite, and I contrast it with the media 20 years ago, there is no question in my mind that this is far better. When you have an open market, of course you're going to have a lot of irresponsibility. But the marketplace has a way, actually, of punishing those who tend to be not credible over time. I would far more be prepared to rely on the marketplace than any dictator determining what should be on the air.
I'll tell you who started all of this. A smart guy named Arthur C. Clarke, who would become the legendary science fiction author. It's October 1945. Clarke is still in Britain's Royal Air Force, and he publishes an outlandish idea in a magazine called Wireless World. It is the concept of the satellite, in space, synchronized to the Earth for the purpose of television. Clarke's article is but four pages long, but it includes this line. A true broadcast service at all times over the whole globe would be invaluable, not to say indispensable, in a world society. Satellite TV's become indispensable, all right. But just how far we've made it toward the other part of Clark's line, the part about world society, remains a question. This despite economic globalization. We now know that fancy communications technology does not lead in a straight line to shared values and a shared vision of the world. Word of European political cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad flew across the earth via satellite, yet the technology did not seem to help many deeply offended Muslims understand why the Danish newspaper printed them. Nor did satellites do enough to explain to many non-Muslims the world over why the cartoons were seen as such a big deal. Lives have now been lost over this. Here's the irony. TV satellites are global in reach, but the messages on those satellites, as we've tried to show in this program, cater to regional tastes, regional bias, regional politics. This confounds and frustrates world leaders who can no longer use television to deliver the party line intact. It also aggravates those of us who want the mass media to be a more consistent force for peace, tolerance, inclusiveness, democracy. Over the last hour, we've brought you some of the complexity being handed to us as Arabic language television catches fire. Some see this rich and unruly marketplace of ideas pumped onto TV screens as ultimately healthy for the region. Others will still choke on the fact that a portion of what gets onto those screens can breed intolerance and violence. That very same Arthur C. Clarke was asked not long ago about the flood of information that his ideas helped unleash, including satellite TV. He readily acknowledged that so much on TV is awful, and as a window on the world, it is often a murky window. Yet to Clarke, stopping the flow is not the answer. Here's his quote. Because we frequently suffer from the scourge of information pollution, we find it hard to imagine its even deadlier opposite, information starvation. This may be something U.S. officials are learning. Who was that visiting Al Jazeera headquarters in Doha this winter? The aforementioned Karen Hughes, close advisor on these matters to President Bush. In Doha that day, there were 2 hours of discussions, and Hughes did grant an interview to that channel. Hughes's title is Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, and she was doing what diplomats are supposed to do. Finding a way to engage a global player too powerful to ignore. For 24/7, The Rise and Influence of Arab Media, I'm David Brancaccio.
The Rise and Influence of Arab Media from the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio was produced by Simon Marks, Kristen McHugh, and Keith Porter. The sound engineer is Rima Snyder of Red Wagon Audio. For more information about 24/7 or to share your thoughts about this program, visit us online at stanleyfoundation.org. Special thanks to Sam Litzinger, Riyad Khawaje, Sassan Tabrulsi, Haytham Abu Saleh, Alia Hamze, Sareen Sabak, Ahmed Aljuni, Najwa Karadche, Sharif Hamdi, Ken Mills, Larry Josephson, Robert Auld, and the Radio Foundation, Vandermilt University Television News Archives, and the staff of Feature Story News. 24/7, The Rise and Influence of Arab Media is a production of the Stanley Foundation and KQED Public Radio, on the web at kqed.org and stanleyfoundation.org.